Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's always fun to talk about new apps. WOSU has a new app for your smartphone. You can go to our website at WOSU.org and presto changeo, pop that app on. So check that out. If you've never had a vegetable garden before, it can be difficult to know how to get started. Should you buy seeds or get starter plants? How much water and sun does an eggplant really need? And should you grow potatoes next to tomatoes? Joining us now to discuss how a new app there can help answer some of those questions is Matt Armstead. He is co-founder and CEO of Sprouted. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Great to be here. Thank you, Ann.
All right. So question for our listeners. Don't wait. Give us a call. But do you use a high-tech garden tool or app to help you get the most from your garden? Give us a call and tell us what you do. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So describe what Sprouted does.
Yeah, I think there's a variety of gardeners that are out there. And when we went out to start this company, let alone the app, we had to consider all the different constituents of users in the gardening space. We're very much in the edible category in terms of vegetables and herbs and fruit. Our goal is to help automate some of the decisions that have to be made during that growing season. It could be from as simple as thinning, from when to transplant something, understanding a frost date. So our app automates a lot of those decisions, gives you a reference point for vegetables and herbs and what you should do, what you shouldn't grow and grow next to each other, how to rotate year over year so that you can kind of keep that garden fresh as it returns to the soil. At the end of the day, we automate a lot of the decisions that gardeners need to make in order to be successful gardeners.
And when you say automate, that means you're like putting, they have alarms or?
Yeah, they get alerts, they get
alerts,
emails.
Right?
So right now we're web-based and we just launched the iPad version of the app. We'll be launching an iPhone version in the fall. So they'll be in apps, the pop-ups that tell you when you should do certain things. Right now they're emails that tell you when you should do certain things. And then when you actually get to the app, there's a lot of notes and reminders as it relates to milestones. So, for instance, when's to transplant something if you started in seed in March, and then all of a sudden, you know, we get a break in the weather and it's time to take things outside. It'll tell you when you should do that. And as your garden starts growing, it'll give you another alert or email when it's time to start thinning things out and moving things around in terms of the garden. So that's essentially what it does. But there's also great reference points. The tonality of the app is very much in tune with being extremely supportive to the consumer and the user.
What do you mean by the tonality?
It's not as you can open up an encyclopedia and it's somewhat academic. And really, we're trying to be quite supportive. We're trying to be a partner in the garden, a tool that they can use. Essentially, it's, you know, hey, it's really time to, you know, turn things around and, you know, we can't wait to see your harvest and can't wait to see that next seed pod grow. It's just a lot of the tonality in terms of the voice of our app is very supportive for the user.
My guest is Matt Armstead. He's CEO at Sprouted. It is a right now web-based and it's going to the iPad as well. It's an app that'll help you organize and what was the word you used?
Automate.
Your gardening if you're new to it or if you're an old hand at it, right?
That's right. That's right. We're really customized for that consumer. We tie it to weather. We tie it to zip codes and USDA grow zones.
Well, I was going to ask you about the zip code thing.
Yeah, so we can make recommendations on the plants that you should or should not be growing based on the area that you're in, as well as the weather and when that breaks. And it will help you based on where you live and what you're growing when you should be doing certain things in the garden.
Does it get into pests and that sort of thing? So different regions have different pests at different times.
Yeah, we start all the way from the very beginning of planting the seed and what you should be doing at that stage and what you should expect. We have illustrations that show various growth stages of the plant so you can kind of reference point to where you're at, all the way to common problem areas that you describe that, you know, we're seeing something yellow on the leaves or we're seeing certain bugs or white bugs or black dots or various things like that. And then even beyond that, as we get into the harvesting season in the fall, what you should do with it, you know, it's kind of plant to plate type inspiration of, you know, what can I do to make a salsa garden and the ingredients that would come with that. So we transcend kind of the full season, you know, all the way to we're going to do some fun stuff in the fall that I'm ready to harvest my pumpkins now. You know, let's do some decorating with pumpkins and things that you can do out front in terms of decor.
Now, are you a gardener? I mean, is this a particular interest of yours, and you decided to, you know, create an app and that sort of thing to...
Yeah, I guess...
is that what you...
First and foremost, I'm a tech entrepreneur.
Okay.
Love starting businesses. I'm part of Founders Factory here in town.
Okay.
We do angel investing, and
right.
A group of designers came to us back in September 2011, and it was a fantastic opportunity. They did a tremendous job on the design of the app, but at that stage, it was essentially a PowerPoint. We've reached out to the market asking if there's a real opportunity around this outside of it just being an app. And we reached out to Miracle-Gro, and they were very excited about what we were doing, and they wanted to partner with us. And over time, we came to an agreement where they're kind of our exclusive sponsor for 2013. And then we'll open up the opportunity for other sponsors to get involved in the app in 2014 and so on. To really enrich the ecosystem that we're trying to deliver, that, you know, much more open to the retailer community, to the services type companies, to a variety of folks. So personally, it's from a tech entrepreneur, from a family perspective, my wife and I are very much into clean eating and healthy eating. We've, work out a lot and enjoy life a lot. So as we look at our kids, we have two boys that are 9 and 11, and we wanted to start growing things in our own garden. So I have a personal interest as well. But the main driver is this is a great tech opportunity as an application and as a business.
You're getting it ready, or it is ready for the iPad now.
We just launched, actually.
Okay.
Our milestones were we launched the app in the first of spring as a web-based app.
Mm-hmm.
And just 2 weeks ago, essentially right around the time that the first day of summer hit, we launched the iPad version.
Okay. And then you said the iPhone by fall.
Yep.
What about Android?
Yeah, we'll hit that too.
Okay.
That's our primary goals. If you look at a lot of our Google Analytics and a lot of the data that we're capturing on the consumer behavior and what devices are hitting it, most of them are coming from an iPhone or an iPad capability. We found the most richness in terms of usability and user experience moving from web to iPad. Just when you get into the app, you'll really notice how rich the content is and how the experience is. And as we move to iPhone, we'll start changing the way the form factor works, the way the app works. We'll be adding inspiration and journaling. And there's a very long roadmap relative to where we're taking the app over time and what that's going to do for the consumer and the shareability of not only sharing your garden and your harvest, but also how you're going to make your journal recommendations on what you do in the years to come and tracking things in progress. So at this point, it's gone very, very far, but we have a long ways to go as well, and Android's certainly part of that roadmap.
So you've partnered with Miracle-Gro, but they're the exclusive sponsor for 2013.
Yep.
That is how you generate revenue for something like this. That's
yeah,
where the money comes from.
Yeah, it wasn't the initial intent. We were kind of looking for the business
opportunity. The usual ads?
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten a lot of kudos from the users. It's a very tasteful way of putting the ads in there. We've embedded video on how to grow tomatoes that Miracle-Gro did. That's very, very well done. The ads are not in your face. It's really about gardening, and that's what the app is. And I think a lot of sponsors or advertisers get a lot of use out of that in terms of what we'll be able to do and extend offers and help as it relates to, having a device in your hand like an iPhone and being near a store and actually getting offers in real time or somewhat a relevant time. So I think that's our best model versus trying to go out and sell an iPad or an iPhone native version app for $4.99 or $3.99. So we actually give ours away for free.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be our best strategy from a go-to-market perspective.
From the tech business point of view, what's to stop Miracle-Gro from just starting? It certainly has the resources from just starting its own app and doing what you're doing, but doing it with the economies of scale that they have and the resources they have.
Honestly, being in the Midwest, trying to start a company, a tech startup, is not the easiest thing to do. there's not a lot of funding out there. We have a lot of ideas. Tech support in terms of technology people that can actually develop really great apps and great design. We've got those resources here. We're just not really well known for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think where Miracle-Gro saw it versus handing it off to an agency to develop or trying to develop it in-house, You have a set of proven entrepreneurs. I've started several companies throughout the Midwest, exited a few, along with my partner, Brooke Paul, who we've had a couple companies together. They saw that being very attractive, kind of a CTO, COO. These guys are thinking about it as a business. And then when you talk about Sarah and Brian being designers and just having a real passion around gardening, they saw that through and through. They saw our ability to really develop it. And at the end of the day, Miracle-Gro's, you know, they're creating great products. They're a great consumer brand. Their focus is on distribution and manufacturing. To go out and build an app and make a business out of it, that's not their primary focus. So to partner with someone that is really looking at it that way and really driven and has a success a successful track record, I think they found that very, very enticing. So we have a multi-year agreement. We're going to do lots of great things together. Not only are they providing us a significant amount of revenue that a lot of people would consider, you know, post pre-seed funding, almost probably closer to Series A type funding, we've done some really interesting things, and now they're making introductions into their retail partners because there's value in that. They have advertising dollars. We've been on Pandora for several months thanks to Miracle-Gro allotting their advertising dollars on our behalf. We're part of their email club. We've gone out several editions of that on a monthly newsletter. We've been on their Facebook fan page multiple times. They've got over 1.3 million fans. So as a consumer brand, it's very difficult for a startup that's not, you know, extensively funded to have that kind of visibility to consumers. So it was a phenomenal opportunity.
I kind of visualize it sort of like a high-tech aging. I mean, it probably shows you what the plant's supposed to. I mean, kind of like a what to expect when you're expecting thing, for plants.
Yeah.
You know, how to get ready, and this is what it should look like when it's this age, this is what it looks like, yeah, and that kind of a thing.
That's right.
And
yeah.
As soon as the app knows what you've planted, it just keeps following along with you that way.
That's right. It's really interesting because we did a ton of research. So not only do we have some great talent internally in terms of content and experts, but we get to leverage Miracle-Gro's experts as well as we build out these plant profiles so that we can automate a decision for a consumer. But there's a lot of data that's just not available. I mean, to understand where a plant should look like at 4 weeks, there's not too many reference points out
right.
there that says it should be, you know, 2 to 4 inches tall and this is what it should look like. So we've spent a good amount of our money on content, and we really are a content app, to show you illustrations throughout the growth stages that you can kind of see where it should look like and what you should be doing in terms of trestles or things like that that help a plant like pea pods or tomatoes grow up versus down and to the side and tip over. So, you know, that's really helped bring some, you know, I guess, proprietary content to us that we've done all that research and we've built a lot of things that are unique to us versus just being, you know, repeating an encyclopedia or copy and pasting something from the web.
Does it give advice for people with limited space, apartment living, balcony-type gardening, that sort of thing?
Yeah, actually, we make a lot of recommendations based on the family size, on how many plants you should grow.
Yeah.
We have an inspirational section that says, hey, I'm going to grow a... You know, we see a lot of millennials. We see a younger crowd thinking about or wanting to be, whether you quote them as foodies or, you know, kind of an urban dweller, if you will. You know, patios, things like that. So container gardens are a big part of what we do, let alone a raised bed or a larger garden area. You know, typically, we're looking at something smaller than an acre that people are going to, you know, grow. We see a huge benefit to community gardening.
Mm-hmm.
We see a huge benefit to families that want to teach their kids how to grow, and they get to kind of interact with technology at the same time be in the garden. So we've had a lot of varieties of people that find value in it, but it could be as simple as, for instance, our inspirational gardens, or we have a salsa garden or a pizza garden that would give you, you know, very explicit plants that you are, you know, typical of those types of situations. Cocktail garden, for instance, that I want to do mint or clove or something like that, that you can do on a windowsill or you can do on a patio or you can do in a larger setting.
Okay. Matt Armstead, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, you bet. Thanks so much.
Matt Armstead, he's CEO of Sprouted. It is going to be available as an app. Well, it is available as an app on the iPad now. It will be on the iPhone and then the Android. So check it out. And when we move on, it will be to something less veggie and kind of depressing. It's patent trolls. So as opposed to garden gnomes. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is a green alternative for used computers. Donating computers makes a positive impact on the environment by keeping toxic e-waste out of landfills. Computers are refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. Donation information at atohio.org.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit wosu.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your membership in 89.7 NPR News.
Program support is provided by the Arts and College Prep Academy. ACPA is now enrolling high school students looking for a safe and vigorous learning environment for all. More information about ACPA can be found online at artcollegeprep.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Patents were designed to help inventors protect their ideas and encourage innovation. But some patent licensing companies that purchase patents and sue others for infringement don't necessarily create anything. And critics say that these patent trolls are hurting innovation. President Obama has issued several executive orders for various agencies to study this practice, and the Federal Trade Commission may be launching its own investigation as well. Joining us now to discuss so-called patent trolls is New York Times technology policy reporter Ed Wyatt. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also with us is Daniel Naser. He is a staff attorney and policy analyst with Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's a group that was founded in 1990 to confront cutting-edge issues defending free speech, privacy, innovation, and consumer rights. So, first of all, why has this practice recently started to get so much scrutiny from the federal government? Daniel?
I think the reason is the explosion in troll lawsuits. They've just grown exponentially in the last few years. We've seen patent suits filed by trolls are now more than 50% of all patent litigation. And that's a really new phenomenon.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about the... my husband waited for months and months and months for an engineering patent to be approved a few years ago. I think Ed Wyatt, you wrote about how the Patent and Trademark Office is issuing about 100 software patents a day?
Yes, and that too has increased in the last few years as the internet has exploded, smartphones have exploded. Some people say there are as many as 10,000 patents on a single smartphone. So the Patent Office has been flooded with these. It tries to approve them quickly. Sometimes the claims are rather broad, and so they end up approving things that later turn out not to be original or, that can be challenged. The number of patents is affecting it because there are more patents for what are called trolls, these companies that buy up patents mm-hmm. and then assert them, asking for licenses to access.
To what extent is the problem with the Patent and Trademark Office and whether or not it's adequately staffed for this?
Well, certainly the Patent and Trademark Office has suffered from a lack of staff that hasn't kept up with the number of patent applications over the last decade. They have, like many offices in the federal government, very antiquated technology, several computer systems that don't talk to one another, and they have a hard time getting people who are qualified enough to understand some of these patents because companies like Google and Microsoft are paying very big salaries for engineers higher than the patent office can afford.
Okay, so not all companies who do this kind of patent licensing are acting like trolls, though, right? There are some legitimate ones out there.
Certainly. There are a couple of things. One is called what's called a non-practicing entity. That's like a university that owns patents and seeks to license them to companies to try to you know, make a product and earn revenues for themselves. Then there are what's called patent assertion entities, otherwise known as patent trolls, that their sole purpose is they generally don't have any operations other than using patents to file lawsuits or threaten lawsuits against companies for often very broad patents and very questionable claims.
I just want to understand clearly, Silicon Valley is hurt by patent trolls more than other sectors, and it's because of this proliferation of patents in the software area.
Yes, I think
okay.
So.
Daniel Nazer, can you explain what's been going on in the world of podcasting?
So right now there is a non-practicing entity called Personal Audio that has filed some lawsuits against companies for podcasting and has sent a lot of letters to even quite small podcasters, folks who are doing podcasts out of their attic and basement, and is threatening to sue them on the basis of a patent. And the dynamic when in patent troll cases like this is very challenging for small companies and individuals because defending a lawsuit in a patent case can cost as much as $2 million. So it creates enormous pressure to settle even when the patent is very weak.
So, and the non-practicing entities, they're willing to settle. That's the whole deal.
Yes, yes. Their business model is to settle with as many people as possible, and usually, particularly the most aggressive patent trolls, they'll sue a lot of people, but they'll accept settlements that are less than the cost of defense, so they can quite easily rack up the money.
So, Ed Wyatt, are just some of these entities just going out of business? Forget the settlement, forget the lawsuit, they just shut down?
There have been companies that have, you know, run out of money or who face the threat of lawsuits and can't defend themselves, can't afford the licenses. I think more often companies, you know, just decide, as Daniel said, to pay it because it costs less to pay for the license than it costs to defend themselves in the lawsuit.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the trend of patent trolls and how they're hurting innovation. If you have a question or comment for my guests, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. My guests, Daniel Nazer, he's a staff attorney and policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Ed Wyatt is a New York Times technology policy reporter. All right, why has the president gotten involved and what actions has he taken exactly? Is that what has to do with the FTC, Ed Wyatt?
Well, the president has done a couple of things. He issued a number of executive orders 2 weeks ago telling the patent office to do certain things, to tighten up some of its requirements on software patents in particular, to look more closely and make it easier for companies that are challenging patents to get access and have a judgment. And also made some recommendations for Congress to take a look at the patent laws and try to update them to discourage this type of activity. Congress passed 2 years ago what's known as the American Invents Act, an overhaul of the patent system. Unfortunately, it left this part of it unaddressed. And so now we've had this boom in lawsuits, which in part was caused by something that was in that act, which said that you can't sue a whole bunch of people all together in one lawsuit. You have to sue each company individually that you think is infringing.
In February, Congress introduced the SHIELD Act, and it was the first, from what I understand, to address the problem of patent trolls. Daniel Nazer, what happened to that bill, and what would it do, or is it doing it?
So the SHIELD Act is still pending, and it would require fee shiftings, and that would change that dynamic I was talking about earlier where the costs of defense pressure people to settle. And so the SHIELD Act would require a patent holder who loses a case to pay the attorney's fees and costs for the other side. And so that case, that legislation is still pending, and there are now four other pieces of legislation Chairman Goodlatte and Senator Schumer have introduced bills, and they have some different fixes for the patent troll problem, but fee shifting is part of a couple of the bills pending right now.
Michael in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I remember back in the 90s, even early 2000s, but especially in the late 90s, there was a form of this that was popular with data domain names for the Internet. So you'd have people that would go out and just buy tons of Internet names that had nothing to do with anything. They would just buy the names, and then they would force somebody like MTV or ESPN or whomever to pay them. And I know at first there were a lot of lawsuits saying, hey, these people have nothing to do with it. This is Ty Dot. And most of those big companies gave in, similar to what it sounds like you're talking about with the smaller companies, because the money that would be spent. But I think somewhere along the road that changed, because that's no longer the popular way of doing things. And I think a lot of courts, or at least judges, stepped up and said, hey, you can't just go out and buy a name that has absolutely nothing to do with what you do for a living and hold a company hostage. Is there some similarity here where you could say, hey, you can't just go out and get these patents that your company really didn't even develop anything? You're just trolling around, grabbing little pieces of it, and then attacking other people, if that makes sense?
Ed Wyatt?
Well, you know, patents trade between companies all the time. You know, it's very common for big technology companies to buy patent portfolios from other firms because they have developed a product that, you know, that they need patent protection on. Patents are part of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 talks about the right to patent. So, and if you have a right to patents, you have a right to buy or sell a property. And so there are companies that are, you know, doing that legally. Now, the legal question, of course, is are they asserting them in a way that's legal, that's not working with other companies, conspiring to take on competitors or put firms unfairly out of business?
Well, so how do you distinguish between patent trolls and legitimate businesses that have a right to protect their patents?
Well, what the Federal Trade Commission has said that it wants to do is to look at these patent assertion entities, see where they are getting some of their patents, and whether there are cooperative agreements with the companies they buy them from. So if a given patent assertion entity buys something from XYZ Corporation, and XYZ tells the patent troll to sue my competitor, ABC Corporation, then and give me back some of the money from the licenses, that could be judged to be collusion and could violate the Federal Trade Commission Act, and that's, you know, and various antitrust laws as well. That's what the Federal Trade Commission is looking to crack down on.
Daniel Nazer, what is the Electronic Frontier Foundation doing to help in this regard? How long have you guys been on it, and what do you do?
So we've been working in the patent policy area for a few years now, and we do a variety of things. We're helping monitor and push for legislative reform. We submitted comments to the FTC urging them to conduct an investigation and consider using their enforcement powers, and we're seeing them do both of those things now. And we also do file what are called amicus briefs in the courts, arguing for interpretations of the patent laws that don't make patents so broad and easy to be abused.
Is this a bigger problem? A lot of patents, don't they come from big corporations anyways, or big software companies anyways?
That's right. The patent sort of IP departments of the big companies are really factories for churning out patents, and some of them have been doing it longer than others, and that's definitely a big source. The patents that fall into the hands of patent trolls often mm-hmm. come out of bankruptcies from the smaller companies.
Okay. So they know what they're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. They're looking for broad software patents that read on the user interface or sort of easy to enforce, easy to find victims.
And or these podcasters that are startup type.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. What next? I mean, Ed Wyatt, as far as the legislation and so forth, how fast is any of that moving? And is, you know, knowing what is going on in Congress these days, is there any hope for it moving at any kind of a healthy clip?
Well, like most things in Congress, it's moving rather slow. Some of the states have started to take action. Hmm. Vermont, the primary example recently, they sued a company, a patent troll, and you know, for what it said was asserting a patent that it didn't have really any business asserting the claims that it did, and requiring, much like the proposed federal laws, for the loser of a lawsuit to pay the expenses of the other party. Now, there are a number of people in Congress who very much support this on both sides of the aisle. You have the president supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are very few barriers to it. There were some proposals to this 2 years ago in the America Invents Act, and some companies, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, lobbied very heavily against it because they were afraid that it would restrict their ability to assert their patents, you know, against generic drug companies. So there is some opposition from the business community. Some of the software trade associations have opposed some of these recommendations as well. So it's not clear sailing. It just matters if there's the political will.
Who are the patent trolls? Do they have names, or are they just sort of these shadowy entities out there, Ed Wyatt?
A lot of time they are shell companies.
Okay.
And you know, individual patent troll companies sometimes form thousands of shell companies that will each send demand letters to operating companies threatening them with a patent lawsuit. Now, there are some very large non-practicing entities, so one called Intellectual Ventures, another called MOSAID, that are run by software engineers themselves. In some cases, they do develop some software technology, but their primary business is buying up patents and sorting through them and looking where they can assert them most easily.
Daniel Naser, are these just good old-fashioned entrepreneurial-type people, or what?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a business model that just taxes the real entrepreneurs, taxes the people who are actually making things. Patent trolls tend to assert the patents very late in the life of the patent, and they've often done really nothing towards actually bringing that kind of technology to market.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Daniel Naser, staff attorney and policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Ed Wyatt, New York Times technology policy reporter. Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. And then Tech Tuesday will continue when we return with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm like a size 100 now. Anyway, I paid like $2 for it. I look like a whore locked out of her apartment.
That's a sketch about how girls respond to compliments from other girls from the Comedy Central show Inside Amy Schumer. On the next Fresh Air, we ask Amy Schumer if she's as slutty as her onstage comic persona. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Tuesday night, join WOSU-TV for American Experience, Henry Ford. From a humble farm boy background, he rose to become the most influential American innovator of the 20th century with the birth of the auto industry. Explore how Ford's automobile forever changed the way we work, where we live, and our ideas about individuality, freedom, and possibility. Watch American Experience, Henry Ford, Tuesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. Discover more about WOSU with the FYIE newsletter. Get emails with program highlights and much more. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For a whole generation of kids, Bill Nye's television show helped inspire a love of science and technology. Production of the show ended in the late 90s, but Bill Nye is still working in science education. Here to tell us more about a new app that brings the world of the science guy straight to kids' smart devices is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks, Anna. I need a warning. The next time you're gonna change the music up on me. That really caught me by surprise.
What do you do when you hear that music?
I'm very calm. It sets me at ease. The bat set me up out of my chair hearing the Bill Nye song.
Okay, Mr. Mellow. Were you a big fan of Bill Nye when you were younger?
I was. Bill Nye was one of the only reasons I sat in front of the television, that and Ninja Turtles. It's pretty much those two things.
Tell us more about his show and how it relates to this new app. What's he doing with it?
He's taking all the videos, or most of the videos, from the show, clips of the different videos, and he and Disney are re-releasing those videos in a free app for the iPhone and the iPad. It's just Bill Nye the Science Guy when you look it up, but it includes a ton of new interactive stuff. So on top of, Bill Nye walking you through an experiment or giving you, some kind of, quick education on how different parts of the scientific theory work, you also get question and answer that they do an exploratory session with Bill's desk, where it's a lot of kind of fun, interactive stuff that you can go through and really kind of, set yourself up as a youngster to create your own small experiments, with parental supervision. But it was really cool to see, that this is, taking all of the same stuff that I watched as a child, and putting it in a format that, it's not just sitting my child down in front of a television. It's something that they can, interact with and learn from. It was really cool to see that.
Now, I see that you interviewed Bill Nye.
I talked to him briefly towards the end of last week. We were talking a little bit about how the app came to be and, the stuff that he's doing right now.
Was that kind of exciting?
It was definitely a cool experience. I don't do a whole lot in the way of interviews in my line of work, and so that was cool.
What age group are we talking about here when we're talking about how the app has been developed?
I would say it's probably good for children under 12. I think anyone over 12, as far as an education goes, would probably find a lot of the stuff not particularly useful or just kind of overly childish. But for anyone under 12, really, even if all they're doing is watching the videos, it's pretty good. The questions are all very basically formed, but also require either understanding the concepts or having just watched one of the videos to get the answers to the questions.
And when it comes to doing the experiments and so forth, does it tell the kid to stop, wait, go get your parent?
There's absolutely some warning there. Their parental supervision is required, and it really takes experiments and breaks them out into pretty simple steps so that parents can be involved but also make sure that the child is doing most of the work, which I think is pretty important for that kind of stuff.
So does this make you happy?
It does. I'm really excited about sharing this with my children because this was, not just a part of my childhood, but also, a really fun way to, continue to get my children involved in science, which I find personally really important.
How much does it take, because these devices are so mobile that they can, use them on, how much does it take them out of the house into the world?
It's really just as much as you allow it. I mean, for the most part, for something like this, a lot of this is probably sitting, at a table or at a desk and interacting like that. But there's certainly nothing that says that these can't, go into the car or go outside.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's one of those things where, from a parent's perspective, this is something that, takes up a certain amount of their screen time per day, as opposed to, adding on to, they get an hour of television and they get, time with this tablet. But that's really just one parenting style versus another at
right.
that point.
Okay, so now for grown-ups, I guess, sending sci-fi. Sci-fi remains into space. Several famous names from the world of science fiction who have passed will have the remains shot into space. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is something that a company called Celestis announced that they're going to be doing. There are parts of some of the remains of Gene Roddenberry, James Doohan, who played Scotty in the original Star Trek, and Arthur C. Clarke are going to be put into a capsule and, you know, shot into space.
Okay, so why?
I mean, really, it's one of those just because things. I mean, it's a time capsule, you know, kind of thing. It's just space instead of the ground. Yeah, but it's really just it's taking these, and I guess there's probably some significant symbolism there, you know, with Arthur C. Clarke and Gene Roddenberry, especially being, you know, two really, you know, generational minds that gave people reason to look up at the sky from a you know, science fiction perspective.
You know, Futurama is ending. It has its last season coming up now, and I was thinking it would make a great episode on Futurama for them to find these remains floating around space and bring them back to life like they did the Nixon head.
That would certainly be funny. But Futurama has been canceled like 9 times now, so it'll come back next month. And
okay, that's just a marketing ploy of theirs.
Well, I think it legitimately gets canceled, but then like there's so much popularity from the fans of people who watch it on Netflix and stuff like that, that it gets pulled back because they think that they can maintain viewership, and then it trails off. It's this weird, you know, kind of spike and dip thing that happens with Futurama as far as the audience goes. But maybe it'll end up being, you know, like Netflix, you know, a Netflix semi-original series, like what just happened with a couple of television shows that they're actually looking to pick up.
And so is there any scientific basis for this, or is it just a nerdly gesture? What is there?
So a lot of this is testing for, you know, this is working with, you know, SpaceX and their Falcon 9 rocket, and some of the work that NASA wants to work on in 2014 with solar sails, and, you know, really just this, there's a lot of other things that are going around it, but the work that's being done specifically by Celestis is really just for the purposes of, you know, having this kind of this kind of capsule, really.
Wow. Okay. And it's not just, you know, Gene Roddenberry and Arthur C. Clarke and those. I mean, it's people who've played on Star Trek too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. James Doohan, who played Scotty, and it's Gene Roddenberry and his wife. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a couple of names here, and a lot of it kind of revolves around the Star Trek series and. But really, you know, the big names that they focused on, you know, when they announced it originally were Arthur C. Clarke and Gene Roddenberry.
Okay. Well, that is really exciting. Maybe next time it's you or me, Russell.
It's really kind of creepy when you think about it. You know, they're kind of taking parts of these people and shooting them into space, but at the same time, it's cool because these are people who, you know, they encourage an entire generation of people to think about space, but were never able to go there while they were alive.
All right.
I tried.
Yeah. It's okay. You know, I mean, it's kind of cool. Like I said, it could be a Futurama episode. I've got hope. I've got expectations now. All right. So PlayStation update fail.
Yeah, this
was
not great.
What happened? What was the update? First of all, what was the update supposed to do? Remind us.
It was this just a really tiny update. It wasn't supposed to do much. They were not overly specific about what it was for. It was supposed to be just a small patch for, you know, for just system level stuff. Nothing serious. And there was a subset of users who found that after they installed the update, the PlayStation would just cease functioning. It would never fully start back up into the normal kind of game menu, and you weren't able to do anything with it. You know, you could you know, wipe your hard drive entirely and start over, but lose all your game information. Some people went as far as to replace the hard drive in it, so that when everything was fixed, they could put the old hard drive back in and you know, still have all their game saves and information. But most people who had this, and it wasn't supposed to be a huge chunk of users, but still, you know, easily, you know, a couple thousand people who were affected by this, you know, for a week now. They've not had access to the PlayStation 3. It hasn't been able to do anything when it starts. And Sony announced that they are intending to fix it. It is something that they think they can fix. They've isolated the issue, but they're not going to have the software update available until the 27th. And it's more than likely going to have to be applied manually, which means taking the update and, you know, installing it on you know, a USB stick of some kind and plugging it into the PlayStation to install the update. But they haven't been totally clear about how the actual update is going to happen. It may be able to happen from they have an internal system menu that you can boot into that may allow it to happen. So if your PlayStation got an update recently and then just kind of stopped working, and as many people who own PlayStation 3s have discovered, they are no longer under warranty for a lot of people. Sony is planning on, you know, doing what they can to fix it later this week.
My guest, once again, Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. I have a few more questions on this PlayStation fail. But if you have a question for Russell on any tech question, you know, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, any kind of tech-related question, and let's see if we can stump the tech blogger. All right, so how does a fail like this happen? This is Sony. I mean, how does something like this happen? Don't they test these things?
That is kind of the big question, and it's not like Sony is the only company to have ever done it, especially in the gaming world. Microsoft had a similar issue not all that long ago. I guess it was fall of last year, where you know they had an update that caused a lot of problems for some users. And it seems like, you know, user testing would be a priority for any update that comes from the manufacturer. And unfortunately, Sony's operating system is such that you can't just revert back to a previous, you know, iteration of the software because it's limited specifically to only update to a newer version. So even if you had, you know, like a saved file from your previous installation of the Sony operating system, there's no way that it could revert back, you know, which is why everyone's stuck waiting for this other update because it can only update forward, which is kind of a bad plan in my opinion, but that's what they ended up getting stuck with.
Did you install this update?
I actually was fortunate enough to not install this update because I was in the middle of moving my entertainment center around when the update happened, so my PlayStation wasn't even plugged in. But I actually would have been one of the users affected. But fortunately, my friends who work in the gaming community, developers who work for different companies reached out to me as soon as they found the problem. And I mean, it was enough that there were the forum where people have for Sony to complain when there are issues and things like that was 70 pages long within the first hour of it being discovered. I mean, there you know, Sony tried to say that there wasn't a ton of people affected, and it seems like, you know, on a grand scale of how many people own PlayStation 3s, it was probably only about 5%. But that's still a lot of people.
Like how many? You know, like what do we know about that? How many?
It's hard to say. I don't know exactly how many PlayStations are out there, but I would say it was easily in the, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of users.
How does it affect, do you think, PlayStation's image with gamers, especially now that a slew of new consoles are coming out? What has this damage? Any damage control out there?
I definitely think that it caused some damage, but it's one of those things that, you know, we have the benefit of a short-term memory.
And you're addicted.
Right. And the new console isn't coming out until the fall.
Okay.
So, you know, this will get fixed. There are definitely some unhappy people right now. And you know, you'll see a couple people saying, well, you know, I'm going to go to an Xbox and whatnot. But the truth is that, you know, the new console isn't coming out until November. And the game community at large has a reputation of having a relatively short memory. So I don't know that this will really cause any trouble for them longer than, I mean, longer than it has right now. I mean, Sony's definitely made bigger mistakes in the past, like when they had their accounts hacked and their servers were offline for almost an entire month.
Oh my God, that's right. So, talk about short memories.
Exactly.
So, if you were lucky enough to have yours unplugged, have you plugged it in yet, or do you just leave it unplugged until this is resolved?
Oh no, they've removed the update.
Okay.
Later that day, and they announced that there was a problem and they were looking into it. So, and they had already. What they'll do is they'll release an update on the 27th that will update all PlayStations to make sure that there's, no chance that this will be a problem.
Okay. I'd be afraid of another update.
There is a lot of people who came in when this first got announced and said, see, this is why you don't update the day that the update is released. This is why you always wait. And it's hard for me to say anything other than, that certainly worked in your favor this time. But really, I am terribly guilty of installing updates the second that they're available. It's something that I do on impulse. So it definitely was beneficial to those who decide to wait. But at the same time, we're moving into a new console generation where one of the big staples is that they're going to start updating on their own. For all of these things, Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, these are all consoles that moving forward, if you're connected to the internet, and one of the big things that Sony said was that even if the console is off, if you've turned it off, the data connection is still live and can still pull updates and install them in the background. So it definitely is kind of cause for concern and makes you kind of want to stand back and go, okay, guys, so how are we going to do this better? Because in the next generation, it could be that you wake up the next morning and your console just kind of installed it for you.
All right. So you said Sony's taking responsibility for it, but a lot of these consoles are out of warranty now. To what extent will Sony fix things?
They'll release instructions for how to
do it yourself.
How to restore, how to do it yourself. If they're unable to connect to a automated backup service of some kind in order to install them.
Okay. Wow. All right. So in the meantime, is everybody coming over to your house to play?
Everyone is welcome to come over to my house to play. You guys want to come from Ohio, you feel free.
Okay. All right. Well, Russell Holly, thanks a lot for joining us again today. Always fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot to everybody for listening. Don't forget to check out the new WOSU Public Media iPhone app. It works on Androids as well. Check that out. You can go to WOSU.org and click on the link there and learn more about it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.